Kathy Hildry and Melissa McCormick will be here to highlight Juneau's celebration of the Marine Highway's 50th anniversary. We'll get a preview of the kickoff Arts Council concert series with Jeff Connor of the Boston Brass. Pat Harris and Odette Edgar will be here to preview Saturday's Harvest Fair at the Community Garden. We'll learn about the Southeast Radiation Oncology Center event on Sunday. That, Writer's Almanac, music, and more. That's in Juneau Afternoon, which is next. Stay tuned. This is KTOO Juneau.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Head Start program used by many Native children is facing national budget cuts. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
Head Start gives low-income children a chance to receive instruction before their formal school careers begin. But like other federal services, the program is in line for budget cuts from the sequestration. The agency that oversees Head Start across the U.S. says South Dakota will need to cut services to 160 children, close 2 attendance centers, and release more than 20 staff members. Kathy Cruz with the South Dakota Head Start Association says it's a dire situation.
The Office of Head Start requires that you maintain a quality program, and so that cuts have to be made across the board so that you don't lose any of the required services. It'll get down to the fact that they've cut everything they can cut, and the only thing that remains is cutting services for children.
Each of the 9 reservations in South Dakota have Head Start programs, with one of the state's largest on the Pine Ridge Reservation administered by Oglala Lakota College. Cruz says tribal officials will determine where their funding cuts will be absorbed. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
Several people at a recent public hearing in Wisconsin asked the State Department of Natural Resources to deny a mining company permission to begin iron ore sampling. As Mike Simonson reports, the proposed mine threatens a tribal watershed.
Of the nearly 100 people who testified at the 10-hour hearing, only 9 spoke in favor of letting GTAC sample 4,000 tons of rock to find out what's in the deposit. Palmins Palgrvasich of Ironwood, Michigan, was one of them.
The pro-mining side says this, the anti-mining side says that. How do they know? How do any one of these sites know without going ahead in the process?
But Bruce Noble of Madison says digging and using explosives and bulk sampling should have the same regulations as full-scale mining, including an environmental impact statement.
If it walks like a mine, if it talks like a mine, it is a mine.
But there was a common theme among many speakers who opposed the mine. They asked the DNR staff to ignore the new iron ore law, which they say doesn't protect the environment or people. Devin Youngbear Sawyer of Bad River says defying the law is the right thing to do.
You are the DNR, and if you do have care in you, you know, please care enough to realize that you don't want your state to die. You don't want your people to die. You don't want your wildlife to die.
DNR Mining and Waste Management Director Ann Coakley says they'll listen to comments and they'll follow the law, so there's no guarantee GTAC will get permission to bulk sample.
I don't think it's a foregone conclusion right now. We need more information, and we will take the comments that we receive from this hearing seriously, and we'll see.
Public comment will be taken through September 3rd. After that, it'll probably be another 2 months before a decision is made. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
The leader of an Oklahoma tribe is facing a lawsuit over allegations of abuse and harassment. As KGOU's Kirk Gortney reports, the chief is not talking about the allegations.
The chief of the Muscogee Creek Nation is being sued by a woman who claims a long-time affair with the chief. She also alleges he physically abused and manipulated tribal staff members to cover up their relationship. Jonna Townsend's lawsuit against Principal Chief George Tiger was filed Monday in Okmulgee County District Court. Tiger told the Tulsa World newspaper he has not read the lawsuit and declined comment. The lawsuit alleges Tiger's relatives harassed Townsend after learning of her relationship with the chief. The lawsuit also alleges Tiger once wrestled her to the ground and took her phone when she threatened to tell his wife of the affair. Court documents also claim he secured consulting jobs for Townsend with the Creek Nation Housing Division and as a personal consultant. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
During this month in 2011, the Aleutic Museum earned accreditation from the American Association of Museums, becoming the seventh in Alaska and the second tribal institution in the U.S. to earn the high-level national certification. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, August 21st, 2013. It's the birthday of the boy who inspired his father to write the children's classic Winnie the Pooh, Christopher Robin Milne, born in London in 1920. His father, A.A. Milne, was an extremely prolific author who wrote plays, novels, mysteries, poetry, and essays, but it wasn't until after Christopher Robin was born that his father began to write for children. His father based the Winnie the Pooh books on Christopher's actual toys and games and the places where he played. His toys were later copied and manufactured in the millions by the Disney Corporation. After the boy grew up and owned a bookstore, parents would take their children to the counter of his shop to say hello to the real Christopher Robin. It's the birthday of poet X.J. Kennedy, born Joseph Charles Kennedy in Dover, New Jersey in 1929. He added an X to his name the first time he sent out a poem for publication because he had served in the Navy on the USS Joseph P. Kennedy and was tired of the association. The New Yorker published that poem, so he felt that the X had brought him luck and he kept it. He originally wanted to be a cartoonist, but he had trouble drawing the same character twice, so he switched to poetry. At a time when most poets had given up rhyme and meter for free verse, he continued to write in traditional forms, and he specialized in humorous poems. He published several collections of poetry, but his biggest success came from the books he wrote for children. Kennedy said, "The tremendous fun of writing in rhyme is reeling in whatever it is you've caught and being surprised by it." And it's the birthday of Robert Stone, born in Brooklyn in 1937. In 1967, he published his first novel, Hall of Mirrors, about a broadcaster for a right-wing radio station in New Orleans. At the time, the Vietnam War was on everyone's mind, so he decided to go out and find out what was going on there. He got a job as a foreign correspondent to Saigon, but instead of focusing on the combat, he uncovered a vast illegal drug trade, which became the subject of his first major success, Dog Soldiers. He has since traveled the world to write novels about all kinds of places, from Central America to Jerusalem, in novels including A Flag for Sunrise, Outer Bridge Reach, and Children of Light. And here's a poem by Carol Ann Duffy entitled Virgil's Bees. Bless air's gift of sweetness, honey from the bees, inspired by clover, marigold, eucalyptus, thyme, the hundred perfumes of the wind. Bless the beekeeper who chooses for her hives a site near water, violet beds, no yew, no echo. Let the light lilt, leek, green or gold, pigment for queens, and joy be inexplicable, but there, in harmony of willow herb and stream, of summer heat and breeze. Each bee's body at its brilliant flower, lover-stunned, strumming on fragrance, smitten. For this, let gardens grow, where bee-lines end, sighing in roses, saffron blooms, buddleia, where bees prey on their knees, sing, praise in pear trees, plum trees. Bees are the batteries of orchards, gardens. Guard them. Virgil's Bees, a poem by Carol Ann Duffy from her collection, The Bees, published by Faber and Faber, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their births. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. This is Billy Collins for the Writer's Almanac, hoping you will join us next time.
And welcome to a Juno afternoon for this damp Wednesday. I'm Laurie Scandling. On the board is Jeff Brown. Our first guests this afternoon are Kathy Hildry and Melissa McCormick, and they're here to talk about the Marine Highway's 50th anniversary. So I started my day today reading a great feature in the New York Times about uncruising on the Alaska Highway, and it captured very well kind of the down-home experience, whether you're from Alaska or not, cruising the Inside Passage. So tell us a little bit about the anniversary, and welcome.
Thank you, Lori.
Thanks, Lori.
Well, we decided that we needed to have a celebration for Juno. Juno kind of was where the ferry system got its start. And there was one brief time this May that they did a little bit of a celebration. It wasn't really, you know, for the community. Some people did show up, but we decided we'd just go ahead and do it. So Southeast Conference partnered with us, and we have a small committee, very few people, but we are working very hard to make this a very successful event on Saturday. And Melissa, with her company, Creativations, is willing to do all the setup work. And I'm going to let her kind of tell you who some of the people are that will be there. And we do have some very important sponsors, too, as well. So, good. Melissa, maybe you can help on that.
Sure. Well, some of our event sponsors are Wells Fargo, Linden Transport, and NC Machinery. We have a lot of other sponsors and in-kind as well, but there's quite a few to list. As far as the activities go, Vic Lehmer will be there doing music. So we've got some music. We've got some hot dogs that will be giving out free hot dogs to celebrate. And then we'll have some other food vendors in line as well. We have JJ's Old Fashioned Hamburgers, Cucamonga's Donuts, and the Kettle Corn Company. Urban Eskimo will be there as well, John Delgado. And the Interact Club from Thunder Mountain High School will also be doing face painting for the kids and have coffee and some baked goods. So it should be a pretty fun time.
When and where?
It will be this Saturday, the 24th. The 24th from 11 to 5. And there will also be a bouncy house. I forgot to mention that. Barefoot Bouncers will be there with a bouncy house for the kids, too. So.
And where can people find the fun?
It will be at the Alaska Marine Highway's Auk Bay Ferry Terminal.
Oh, right there in the parking lot.
Yep.
Then. Great. Well, let's talk a little bit of history about the Alaska Marine Highway and its significance to the region. It really is a highway. We could not get from community to community unless it were by water or by plane. So, Kathy, you're known as an organizer in this town. I know you were very involved in our 50th anniversary of statehood. What motivated you to do this when there was kind of an acknowledgement in the spring?
I just think there wasn't enough for Juno. You know, they moved a lot of the ferry system people to Ketchikan several years ago and kind of took away what we felt was part of our highway system, you know, even though the ferries come here. We depend on the ferries in Southeast Alaska. We need to have them be part of our community. And I think the people in Juno really realize that, especially the ones that go to Tenneke or Hoonah or now Gustavus. This is really how we get around in Southeast. And so we decided this is an opportunity for us to get together. And I went to Shelley Wright with Southeast Conference, and she and I talked about it. It's their catalyst, really. It's their part of their what they believe in, which is, you know, they'd like to have a road. Everybody would like to have a road, but we're probably not going to see that anytime soon. So we, and Shelley talked to the Department of Transportation Commissioner, Pat Kemp. Pat said, go ahead and have whatever you'd like. So we came up with this idea to make it very community orientated, and we asked these sponsors to help us. I want to thank Jim Wilcox and his wife for going out and getting some in-kind and some money donations. Linden Transport has really stepped up to the plate, and they're going to pick up tables and chairs from the Filipino community. And, of course, a lot of these people that are involved, as you well know, KTOO 360 North has done the wonderful video. And I'd like to tell everybody out there in Radio Land that we're going to show the second part of it that Saturday. It's going to be shown.
Oh, fantastic. And this is the four-part series,
yes,
on the Alaska Marine,
right,
Highway history.
History, right. And it will not be shown until Saturday. So if people want to see it, they're going to have to come to the Auk Bay Ferry Terminal to see it.
Exciting.
Yeah. It'll be fun. I mean, it's the retirees that we are encouraging to come as well. Canvas is coming with some fun things for the kids to do and things that they've already done for the 50th year of our Marine Highway System, and they're going to have things for kids as well. And they're also going to have a guest book that people will get to sign. And there's also a big surprise that we're going to unveil that day. And it's I promised I wouldn't say anything any more than that. So hopefully the people out there will say, oh, what you up to now? But there will be something that everybody will get to take away with them when they come to the event.
And that guest book really will be a part of history. I
yes,
imagine
it will
be parked with the State Library or perhaps with the new archives facility we have here. But just like any other event where we register that we were there, it is a historical moment.
Right, and I think that's what people, you know, come to do in Juneau. They come to this event, and we're having it kind of in the Banana Belt. If anybody lives in that area, and I think you do, Lori, you know that sometimes we have lots of rain and wind in downtown, and I've been watching the forecast. 30% chance, 60 degrees, and so I'm hoping that Saturday will produce some nice weather for us.
It is true statistically, yeah, that the Auk Bay area, because of the way it's located and tilted, actually, in a
right
way, in that southerly direction, does tend to have some better weather. Kathy, do you know if Southeast Conference has researched at all the multiplier effect financially on Southeast Alaska of the Alaska Marine Highway, both in Alaskans who are employed and those who travel through the region and spend money?
You know, Lori, I probably should have that information. Unfortunately, Shelley's in Europe with Pippin and her daughter, and so she was not able to be here for this interview, and she will be there on Saturday when she gets back. But I'm sure there is some statistics as
sure
well. You know, I think Marine Highways has done a great job. They've tried to help out all the communities, no matter whether it's school, you know, school districts or you know, people that need to get into town for some sort of an event. I think the ridership is up. You know, our ferries are old, as you well know, and we're dealing now with the Tustamina up north, it's not ready to come out so those people can have a ferry. But I'm an advocate of Southeast Alaska, and I have to say this is where it started. And we're having this because we feel the community of Juneau needs to know that we like the ferry system and that everybody that's had a party felt the same way. So we're just adding a little bit more frosting to what was done early in May.
Well, I recall the day I pulled in on the Alaska ferry. It docked right across the street downtown, and it was a deceptively gorgeous day here in Juneau. So I would bet if we went on the street right now and did some polling, probably half the people would say, oh, yeah, I arrived in Juneau on the ferry. So it really has been our lifeline in so many ways.
Yes, it has, and we've all, I think, enjoyed it. My husband and I take it at least once or twice a year. That's our mode of transportation. And I think they try to do a nice job. They've been very good about, you know, making sure that the ferry's there for you when you get to the terminal. If there's any problems, they let you know ahead of time.
And it's affordable.
And it's affordable,
yeah,
yes.
What I'm seeing with my children is that because of the sports activities being cut so drastically and that $400,000 grant is now gone, a lot of our travel will be via ferry, and so we are very gracious and very you know, appreciative of the fact that it is a lower cost of way for our children to travel for sports and activities.
And it's a homey environment, too.
Yeah, I came up here on the ferry. I drove up from Arizona all the way up through Prince Rupert and got on the ferry, and that's how I got here as well. So.
Well, great. So we are looking to celebrate 50 years of the Alaska Marine Highway System, in Juneau in particular, this coming Saturday, 11 to 5, at the Auk Bay Ferry Terminal. There will be a surprise unveiled, and it sounds like lots of fun family-oriented activities and some free food as well.
That's correct. There will be free food, and I want to make mention that the firemen auxiliary, the women of the Juneau Fire Department, have come together with an auxiliary, and it's going to be their time to kind of showcase for themselves. They're going to have the free hot dogs. We'll have other vendors there that will be selling hamburgers, and as Melissa said, it'll be a variety of food. We're not having a lot, but we have just a smitten of things that people will be able to have lunch and a late afternoon snack, and just the music. The music will be kind of fun, too. Vic Lehmer's going to be there with his music, and so we're going to have fun.
Keep our fingers crossed for a dry day. It doesn't have to be sunny. Just needs to be dry.
We're putting up tents, so it will be dry.
Regardless.
If you don't plan on that, then it will rain.
Is it the second installment on the Alaska Marine Highway System?
Yes, it is.
Will be aired that day, and that is a production of KTOO. Thank you for joining us. Looking forward to the event.
Thank you, Lori.
All right.
Life goes on day after day. Hearts torn in every way. So ferry across the Mersey, 'cause this land's the place I love, and here I'll stay. People, they rush everywhere, each with their own secret care. So ferry across the Mersey, and always take me there, the place I love. People around every corner, they seem to smile and say, we don't care what your name is, boy, we'll never turn you away. So I'll continue to say, place I love, and here I'll stay, and here I'll stay, here I'll stay.
This is Bird Note. I bet you've heard this sound before, maybe on the soundtrack of a movie. It's a bird voice so distinctive, it's become one of the best-known sounds in nature. This oddly familiar, crazed laughter belongs to the laughing kookaburra of Australia. Its exotic call has been a Hollywood standard for decades, that unseen creature lurking in the depths of the African jungle, or any jungle for that matter, in movies with heroes ranging from Tarzan to Indiana Jones. But in reality, just what kind of birds are kookaburras? They're hefty members of the kingfisher family, found primarily in Australia and New Guinea. The laughing kookaburra, one of four species of kookaburras, stands 18 inches tall and is the largest of all kingfishers. Unlike our familiar waterside kingfishers, kookaburras live in open woodlands and dive from branches to capture snakes, lizards, and mice. The bird's name, which imitates its raucous call, derives from an Australian Aboriginal language, Wiradjuri. It's also earned the name Bushman's Clock, Breakfast Bird, and Alarm Bird for its reliable habit of loudly ringing in the dawn. Listeners support our show. Thank you. I'm Michael Stein.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'd like to thank Jeff Brown for programming the fun music that we have between our guests. Our next guest is Jeff Connor. He's with Boston Brass, the Enzo Quartet, and we have Jeff on the telephone with us. Welcome, Jeff. Glad to have you here.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well,
thanks so much for having me.
You bet. It's we're lucky to have you on here. And I know that you want to talk about an event that is on September 20th. Could you tell us what that is?
Absolutely, be happy to. It's a really great collaboration with I play trumpet with Boston Brass, and we collaborated with a string quartet a few years ago in Singapore called the Tang Quartet, and we designed a program that was based all on music on Romeo and Juliet, and we did the Prokofiev Romeo and Juliet. We did the Bernstein Symphonic Dances from West Side Story. We did some of the Juliet letters of Elvis Costello. You know, just a wonderful program. And then we thought, well, we need to do more of this. So we hooked up with the Enzo Quartet here in the United States, and we've been doing the program ever since. And the program is Boston Brass plus the Enzo String Quartet, and then we have two percussionists and a piano player. So it's a fabulous music, and it's a lot of fun.
So how many people total? Obviously, a quartet is four, and you mentioned a couple of others. What's the total group that will play?
There'll be 12.
And do you all live in different parts of the country?
We all live all over. Boston Brass is, some of the guys are in Miami. I'm in Boston. One is in Las Vegas. The Enzo Quartet, they're kind of scattered all over the states as well. Our percussionist is from Ohio. Piano player lives in Michigan. So yeah, kind of all over. So we'll be flying up to Juneau in a few weeks.
So dumb question. How do you practice?
We do the program. We always fly in a day or so before, and then we'll rehearse the day before. So, and we have a program with them. So
you mentioned that when you had the first collaboration, the theme was around Romeo and Juliet. Is that the same program all the time?
It is.
Oh, it is. Okay.
It's called Notes from the Balcony is the title of the program. And again, it's all music based on Romeo and Juliet. So we'll be doing the symphonic dances of Leonard Bernstein from West Side Story. We're going to be doing a whole big suite from Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet. The quintet, Boston Brass, is going to play three pieces from by Dmitri Kavalevsky from a ballet he did of Romeo and Juliet. And then the Enzos are going to play some of the Juliet letters of Elvis Costello.
Why that theme?
I think there's just so much great music based on that story. You know, and just, so many composers. We were doing, just finding out about the program. It was hard to whittle down, what's kind of taking, the best composers and, what they've done with that theme. And it's just fantastic music.
And Jeff, what's your role in this collaboration?
I'm the only original founding member. I'm the original founding member of Boston Brass. I've been playing with the group for 26 years. I play trumpet with the band, and I kind of do the day-to-day scheduling and keep everybody, try to keep us as busy as possible.
And have you been to Juneau before?
We have. We were there, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, 8 years ago, for the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival.
Oh, great. So you have a sense of our community then.
We love it. We've been looking forward to coming back. As soon as we knew we were going to be coming back up to Juneau, we were really excited.
So
it's a beautiful part of the world. I mean, we've been to Alaska a few times, so it's fantastic that we're returning.
So Romeo and Juliet is a story that appeals to many ages, depending on its interpretation. What age group would you say this is appropriate for? Would this be okay for kids, for example?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we really don't go into the story of Romeo and Juliet, you know, and we may talk a little bit about it, but it's all about the music, 100%. It's just great seeing everybody up on stage and, you know, just seeing the collaboration between the two groups. It's virtuosic music. Just seeing everybody up there doing what they do. We have the strings are mic'd, so we make sure they come through. And, the music is definitely for all ages. You know, the Prokofiev is definitely more classical-oriented, and the Bernstein, the West Side Story, is definitely more jazz-oriented.
And I'm just curious, if the Boston Brass has collaborated then with other musical entities as well, with the same idea of creating, of synthesizing something new from a couple of groups collaborating?
We have. We've been really fortunate to do that, besides collaborating with the Enzo Quartet for this Notes on the Balcony program. We've been collaborating with a woodwind quintet out of New York City called the Amani Winds. It's a fantastic woodwind quintet out of there. And we do a program with them called Sketches of Spain. And it's music, the Sketches of Spain and Porgy and Bess Suites by Miles Davis and Gil Evans. So we've been doing those. And then also every December, we have a collaboration with just a bunch of brass players. We have a big holiday show that we do, the Stan Kenton Christmas Carols. So it's a big 15-piece brass big band. And we go and have a whole kind of holiday variety show where we do a lot of the Stan Kenton charts and Boston Brass plays. We bring in, you know, a lot of our friends get a chance to solo. And it's a lot of fun. It's a great holiday show.
Stan Kenton was a classic jazz player from the late 40s.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then throughout the year, we play with orchestras. We just got back last week. We were down in Costa Rica. We were playing with the National Symphony Orchestra down there. And then we'll play with wind ensembles and all throughout the year as well.
Well, it sounds exciting. Jeff, thanks for spending time with us this afternoon. We've been talking with Jeff Connor. He plays trumpet with the Boston Brass. He's a founding member of that organization 26 years ago. And that organization with the Enzo Quartet is collaborating to bring to Juneau on September 20th, Notes on the Balcony, a collaboration that focuses on the theme of Romeo and Juliet. Great. We look forward to having you here, Jeff.
Can't wait to come back to Juneau.
All right. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me. Okay. Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Lori Scandling on Juno Afternoon. My two guests are Pat Harris and Odette Edgar, and I'm looking at a beautiful poster of some very colorful vegetables,
And we're talking about the Harvest Fair at the Juneau Community Garden. That is this Saturday out on Montana Creek Road. I had never seen the community garden until this summer when I went hiking out there. And as we drove past, there was this lush acreage of all kinds of plots. What a wonderful year for gardening in Juneau. Tell us a little bit about what's happening on Saturday.
It has been really a terrific year, and we are doing our 21st annual Harvest Fair. And so that means from 11 o'clock until about 1:30, we will have a farmer's market with produce that's been raised at the community garden. And we also have a lunch concession. We have, just briefly here, chicken bingo, which is a big hit.
Wait, stop right there. Help me understand this.
Okay. Well, it involves chickens on a sort of like a big bingo board, and people sort of guess where they might place, the chickens might place their markers. And so there are little prizes for best guesses, and it is just really one of the funnest things.
That is worth the drive out to Montana Creek Road right there.
Yes, that is fun.
So a farmer's market, so there is enough surplus produce to sell then?
There is.
Yes, yeah, we got quite a variety of things.
Yeah, and we'll have carrots, which is probably the most popular thing that we have, zucchini, rhubarb,
some potatoes, although it's fairly early for them, but we'll have some potatoes.
Yeah, herbs. Sometimes people bring in preserves that they've made or jams or jellies. So a number of things. Oh, kale. We have kale ready.
Herbs.
Yeah. Did I mention zucchini?
Yes. Okay. We have a bumper crop this year.
They tend to do that when there's lots of sun.
Yeah. I have been taking zucchini and dropping it off on my friends' porches and putting it in their cars.
Anonymously.
Yes, and they are not just little
now
discreet.
You're busted.
Yeah. They're not little discreet zucchini. They are great big giant zucchini.
The size of one's
thigh.
Well,
you hear about what's happening in farm country down south, but this is the first year I've ever heard about it in Juneau. People usually quite thrilled to get them, and, you know, there's quite a bit of competition for your excess zucchini, but...
Exciting. Yeah. Well, you said there would be a lunch served as well? Talk a little bit about that.
We do a concession stand, and we serve hot dogs, and we have chili that is made by members of the garden, so homemade chilies of different sorts. We also have, things like chips and homemade desserts, and I think there's going to be fish that will be grilled and corn on the cob. So it's a nice little lunch that, people
can
get.
Very reasonable price, too, I think. Yeah. It's kind of a plate price for it.
Yeah. What will it run, do you know?
Think about I hate to put this, make this a public statement, but last year was about $5 per plate.
Sure. Yeah. Now, I see that it appears that there's some kind of competition. It says exhibitors enter the exhibits, and it looks like photos will be taken from 9:30 to 10:30. What's the competition about?
Well, it's really a fun thing. So this year I'm expecting a lot of entries. So people enter their vegetables. We have a lot of different classes of vegetables and flowers. So we should get wonderful entries in both vegetables and flowers. We have a new division in the vegetable section this year. Division is called Produce Sculpture, which is being very creative with your vegetables. And it's rated PG, but should encourage a lot of creativity, we hope, with kids and also the young at heart and just people that like to do artwork. So
you sculpt a vegetable into something?
Well, or put pieces of vegetable
together and
other things together. Like you could use lichen for hair and
all kinds of things. Oh, so it doesn't just have to be something that you grew in the garden?
I don't think so. The rules are kind of loose. This is the first year we've done it, so I think it's...
Okay, organic material.
I would say the rules are non-existent.
Except we do have that one caveat that there are
PG.
Some carrots that are rather suggestive, so we are... We are limiting, we're trying to be a family show here.
Yeah.
I also see that there's something quite important happening from 11 to 1:30, and that is if you want a plot at the community garden in 2014, you sign up
Saturday. And if we don't, it's an opportunity for current garden members to renew, and if they're in good standing, then they have the first choice on their current plot. But usually we have other plots that open up, and... I'm the person in charge of membership this year, and every single person that has come to me has been able to get a plot.
How many plots are there? How many members?
There's 150 plots, and we have about a little over 100 members. So some people have more than one plot.
And when you say member, is there a membership fee, or do you have some chores associated with your membership? How does that work?
Right. So there is a fee for each plot. The plots are 10 by 20, and the annual fee for that size of plot is $35. And then there is a five-hour service hour requirement, which means you work on community garden projects, so mowing the grass and doing some of the other things around there that kind of serve the whole garden.
Where did the land come from? Was this municipal property, or was it donated by a private individual? Did it get purchased through a series of donations? I'm interested in that.
Well, we are leasing it from the city, and we're under the auspices of Parks and Rec, so there are connections to the city. And I understand it used to be a drag track. Was kind of a gravel pit and
motocross.
Right. So, mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
I kind of do. Yes, I do.
I think that was a little bit before I came to Juneau, but yeah. So the whole base of the garden is gravel, and all the soil has been built up on top of that from various amendments that we brought into the garden. Brewer's grain that we got from the brewery when we were able to do that, and various other organic stuff. People bring seaweed in every fall, and so most of the gardens have pretty good soil now.
So we did have a really fabulous summer. We had plenty of sunshine. What have been the challenges this year? I would guess in past years it would be probably too much moisture or not enough warmth. What kind of challenges might gardeners have faced this season?
Well, I think a lot of things matured earlier than we thought, and so things bolted fairly quickly sometimes. There's a lot of sun, and we had a lot of watering to do this summer, which I didn't hear anybody grumbling about it, but...
It's a little unusual.
Yes, there was a lot of watering to be done. The slugs were not as bad as usual, so that was a plus.
I noticed that around my place. I only saw one monster that I got. What's the most unusual thing that's grown out at the community garden?
Well, I just saw something in my neighbor's plot that was... It might have been a kohlrabi that looked like the size of a small basketball. It was like...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. What have you seen, Pat?
Well, there's some pretty good artichokes this year, and leeks are fairly popular to grow. Most of the garlic has been harvested already, so people won't see that growing, but there should be some entered in the fair. What else? Oh, fennel. And that was a problem with the fennel. It bolted earlier than I expected, so I didn't harvest the bulbs in time.
So it looks like that the exhibits will be available for everybody to see throughout the public period, which essentially is 11 to 1:30, unless you want to enter the competition, and then you need to be there by 9:30.
Actually, Lori, the public won't be able to see the exhibits until noon because the judges are busy looking at them from 10:30 until noon. So,
But they will be available
afternoon
then until 1:30.
Right.
And who serves as judges?
Well, Ed Bajarski is in charge of them, and he organizes them every year, and it's always kind of a surprise to us who turns up, but they're always very competent and good gardeners, and it's really an interesting process to watch, so yeah.
What makes it interesting? Meaning how
Listening to their discussions about the quality of things, and we have some standards that we like to go by that we encourage the gardeners, the exhibitors, to look at when they're entering stuff, and that's the judges consider that too. So it's a certain number of things. Things have to be fairly clean and uniform size. The size should be just about what you might buy in a store. And then we do have a large, humongous class as well. So if people have a really big zucchini, they can put it in that.
That would be a fun competition to see this year.
It's going to be exciting.
There's these categories, in addition to the produce sculpture, there's also the largest vegetable and also the most unusual vegetable. So we get some really fun things. Last year, there was a zucchini that was so huge, it was on its own little royal pillow. It was just... pretty amazing.
Well, there's one dressed up as a baby, remember?
Oh,
had a baby bonnet on.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this is not to be missed, obviously. Golly, just great to hear about this. We're talking with Pat Harris and Odette Edker about the 21st Annual Harvest Fair out at the Community Garden, which is on Montana Creek Road.
Yes.
Give the directions, because folks might not know how far out Montana Creek Road you need to go to find the Community Garden.
Okay, it's turn onto Montana Creek Road off of the road that you would go to West Glacier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you turn off the back loop as if you're going to West Glacier, and then you go about half mile or three quarters of a mile, and then there's a fork to the left, and that is Montana Creek Road. And we are shortly down that, maybe a quarter of a mile a day.
Yeah.
They're left at the fork, and it's obvious once you get on that.
Right, and we're just past the Juno Gun Club, which is on the right.
Yep.
And we should mention about parking probably, too, if we have a minute.
You bet.
Okay, so parking at the garden is sometimes pretty crowded. We get a big crowd, and so this year we're able to use the Juno Gun Club as an auxiliary parking lot, so we're very grateful to them for allowing us to do that. So we'll have a little more room.
Great.
Yeah, they have 40 spaces there, so that's great. And we have people at direct parking now. So they'll be out there on the road, and if the garden parking lot's full, they'll be directing people to the gun club parking lots. Yeah.
Sounds like a lot going on in just a couple of hours. From 11 to 1:30 this Saturday, the Harvest Fair out at the Juno Community Garden. That is on Montana Creek Road, bear left at the fork. You'll see vegetables and flowers entered in a variety of categories for the competition, as well as a sculpture competition. There will be a lunch available and a farmer's market. All local produce after a bumper crop of a summer. So thank you so much for joining me. Hope you have
Lori.
A nice turnout.
Thank you, Lori.
It's early morning, not quite four. The farmer's up and out the door. On little farms all through the state, they're loading bushels, box and crate, while you're sleeping safe and sound. The farmer's driving to your town, bringing fresh grown, fresh picked food your way as the sun wakes up today. At the farmer's market, close to home, all the food you'll find there is locally grown. Like a farm once a week in your neighborhood, it's Farmer's Market Good. And in the park, some local gents set up the tables and some tents. The little trucks come rolling in, and soon the market can begin. Flowers straight from the flower bed, and some fragrant, still warm bread. Fruits and veggies of every shape and size, and delicious home-baked pies. At the Farmer's Market, close to home, all the food you'll find there is locally grown. Like a farm once a week in your neighborhood, it's Farmer's Market Good. Good for your breakfast, good for your lunch, good for your dinner too. Good for the farmer, good for the family, best of all, good for you. The market changes every week, depending what crop's at its peak. First is rhubarb, lettuce, peas, then spinach and strawberries. The local peaches are so nice, watermelon by the slice, heirloom tomatoes, corn so tall, and apples in the fall. Good for your breakfast, good for your lunch, good for your dinner too. Good for the farmer, good for the family, best of all, good for you. So if it's still a bit too hard to try and till your whole backyard, there is a place right down the street where all your savvy neighbors meet. Like the seeds that the farmers sow, your whole community will grow. 'Cause beside all the best that the farmer sends, you'll find a brand new crop of friends. At the farmer's market, close to home, all the food you'll find there is
grown. Like a farm once a week in your neighborhood. It's Farmer's Market. Farmer's Market. Good for the farmer, good for your family. Farmer's Market, good.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Our next guest is Dr. James Blum, and we are going to be talking about a special event this Sunday at the Southeast Radiation Oncology Center called Come Sign Our Wall. Are you there, Dr. Blum?
I am.
Thank you for joining us today by telephone. We appreciate it. And where are you right now?
Right now I'm in Soldotna.
You're in Soldotna. Tell us about this oncology center. I did not know there was any kind of oncology treatment available in Juneau.
Well, you know, there has been chemotherapy available. Dr. Wyden has been coming up from Seattle for years to give chemotherapy, but patients have always had to go usually down to Seattle or up to Anchorage for radiation therapy. And, you know, a large percentage of patients with cancer ultimately require radiation therapy at some point in their treatment. And so we decided to go ahead and open a center down there in Juneau to serve that entire southeast region to try to help keep people closer to home.
And who's we?
Well, it's the physicians up here are me, Dr. Halligan, Dr. Bertuccio, and myself. We are going to be having a full-time physician dedicated solely for that practice down in Juneau, though. His name is Eugene Wong. He is a phenomenally good physician, MD Anderson trained. And, you know, we plan on having that center be every bit as important and sophisticated as what we have in Soldotna or in Anchorage. So, in other words, I think it's important for people to understand that just because it's a smaller community doesn't mean that we're giving it any less attention. So there will be a full-time physician there all the time. He and his wife and young kids are very excited about moving to the area, and he'll be there this weekend, actually, at the wall signing.
Tell us about the wall signing.
You know, we did that here in Soldotna when we opened this facility. Basically, what it is this. There's patients and their families express interest in wanting to try to write some inspiring words to patients who are under treatment now. And so what happens is the linear accelerator goes into a vault. It's a big concrete shelter, basically. And so during the sign-the-wall ceremonies, people will come, current patients, former patients, family members, et cetera, and they'll come and they'll write whatever they want on those walls. And usually they're very, very poignant, inspirational little messages. And then when people are done with that, we go and we take photographs of all of them. And we've made little booklets that patients, when they come to treatment, can see what is behind these walls. So when they're laying there on the linear accelerator getting their treatment, they're sort of surrounded by the good wishes and positive thoughts and inspirational expressions by former patients and family members. And we think that's the nice the appropriate tone to have for patients who are on treatment.
What time on Sunday could folks drop by to write their message on the wall?
Yes, ma'am. It's going to be between 2 and 5, and there will be a the chaplain from Bartlett Hospital will be coming in and sort of blessing the center, blessing the vault at around 4 o'clock. But between 2 and 5 o'clock, we'll be available to have folks come and basically lend their 2 cents to the Cancer Center and to future patients.
Where is the center located here in Juneau, and when do you expect it to open to accept patients?
Well, the center is the address is 1701 Salmon Creek Lane. It's over by the hospital. You can't miss this one; just one block from the hospital. We are expecting to obtain occupancy in October, and then the linear accelerator will be installed. And it takes a good couple months to get all that commissioning done, and we're hoping to be treating first patients by the end of the year.
By the end of the calendar year, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
And why did you and your colleagues have an interest in Southeast Alaska if you are up north? What brought
you
to this decision?
Yeah, you know, we've been trying to support patients down there for a while now. We do via the web and telephone monthly tumor boards with the doctors down at Bartlett, and you know, we see patients that come up from Southeast and come up to Anchorage, and obviously we don't see the ones that go down to Seattle, but you know, we decided that there really was a sufficient need there, that there was enough of a volume that it warranted going ahead and trying to put a center in there. You know, same thing happened here in Soldotna. These people here in Soldotna had to either drive 3 hours every day, each way back and forth to get to Anchorage for the radiation, or they had to fly and stay there, and that gets to be not only expensive, but it's very disruptive to their lives. You know, cancer is you know, it's enough to have the diagnosis of cancer and to be going through treatments. You don't need to add the stress of being away from family, maybe not being able to work if you have to go to Anchorage or Seattle for, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks. Having normalcy in your life as much as you possibly can is really important during your cancer treatment. And so I think that it's been very, very well received here in Soldotna, and I hope it will be down there as well.
So you mentioned the term vault, which is kind of a daunting term to think about in terms of how, you know, one would be treated inside the vault. What kind of investment has your organization had to make in order to get this vault, which I assume is where the radiation occurs?
Sure. The vault is just simply, you know, you need to have something that stops the radiation from going outside. And so you basically have big, thick concrete walls. And so that's what the vault is. It's just a big concrete, you know, room. The investment is substantial. You know, this technology, we're putting in, you know, the cutting edge linear accelerators, and those aren't cheap.
What I was wondering, if it's new equipment and.
Absolutely. As I said, everything there is going to be brand new, state of the art. As I said, it's important to realize that this is not just, you know, sort of an afterthought, throw something down there and make do for a smaller population. No, this is going to be the same equipment that we put in here in Soldotna, brand new linear accelerators, brand new treatment planning systems, everything brand new, and the same type of equipment that we have in Anchorage. So it's all going to be state of the art. There's going to be nothing that's secondhand. It'll be every bit as sophisticated technologically as what you would have if you came to Anchorage or went down south to Seattle.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. We've been talking with Dr. Jamie Blum, who currently is in Soldotna. He and colleagues will be opening the Southeast Radiation Oncology Center, which will be accepting patients by the end of the year. And if you'd like to sign the wall, giving good wishes to those who may be experiencing treatment there, please drop by this Sunday afternoon between 2 and 5 at 1701 Salmon Creek Lane. Thank you, Dr. Blum.
You're very welcome. I appreciate your time.
This has been Juno Afternoon for Wednesday. On Thursday, Annie Bartholomew will host, and we'll talk with director Maxine Trump about her film Musicwood, showing this week at the Gold Town. You'll find out what's showing at this weekend's Jump Society Showcase. That's a film festival. We'll talk to Michelle Kelke about youth hockey and Saturday's gear swap. Sammy Burrows will be here to preview this Friday's summer blowout at Rockwell. And, of course, Nancy DeCherney will be up with Arts Up, and that is Thursday afternoon. This is KTOO-FM. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. K2 also broadcasts on these translators in the Valley and Auk Bay, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens at K201 AM 88.1. K22BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN is at 872, KXLL at 873. And, of course, we're online at www.kto.org. Thanks for joining me, Lori Scandling, and Jeff Brown for Juno Afternoon.
On the